Russian ships stand accused of mapping the floor of the North Sea. Could their goal be sabotage?
We cannot state that all of them are somehow engaged in espionage, but we can say that we've documented suspicious behavior.
Investigative reporters allege ships may be preparing to interfere with wind farms or communications cables. And the owner of the only Yemeni restaurant in Boston is sharing his roots.
Food is the one language that everybody understands. I wanted to do the food as well as the culture with it.
To break the fast during Ramadan, he's serving up special dishes, decorations, and hours. Also today, artists from Ghana mix it up to bring people together.
We are taking the listeners on a ride, a roller coaster ride, and we are asking them to come along with us on this journey and stay gripped to us.
The music of Fra will grip you. All that and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for being with us today. Russian ships disguised as fishing trawlers and research vessels have been mapping the floor of the North Sea and conducting underwater surveillance. Their goal, to be able to cut power and data cables that serve Europe. All this according to a joint investigation by public broadcasters in Denmark, Norway, Sweden, and Finland. Maria Georgieva is based in Sweden and is one of the investigative journalists involved in the project. Maria, what was the initial tip-off that led the Scandinavian broadcasters to explore this idea that Russia might be deploying spy ships in the North Sea?
Well, from the beginning, we actually started looking into the situation in Europe and in the Nordic countries after the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, actually. So this is an initiative we took ourselves to see what kind of traces can we find of Russian espionage in the Nordic countries. And then we started to contact sources from different intelligence communities who could tell us more, especially about how espionage boats can be disguised as fishing trawlers or scientific research vessels in the North Sea. And we started to follow up on several leads and tips to see what we can find. We did receive information from anonymous sources as well, but we always try to confirm the information we got with at least two sources or more. And one of these reports that we focus on is this Russian vessel called Admiral Vladimirsky.
So we'll get to the Admiral Vladimirsky in a moment, but I mean, I imagine there are a lot of fishing boats out there in the North Sea. So in your investigation, how did you figure out which ships were involved in this mapping of the floor of the North Sea and which were just regular fishing vessels?
We were actually, with our Norwegian colleagues, we did this mapping with the help of so-called AIS system, which tracks Russian ships and map their routes, actually, at sea. And we found, together with NRK, our Norwegian colleagues, that 50 ships, for example, around Nordic waters were behaving strangely. And they visited military sites, NATO exercises, mapping of infrastructure and gas pipelines, communication cables. Of course, we cannot state that all of these ships are somehow engaged in espionage, but we have been able to document suspicious behavior that took place over many years. Mm. And they were going back and forth from these sites. And especially when it comes to visiting military sites, that was what caught our immediate concern and like our attention. So we wanted to look into that even more.
Gotcha. Now, you mentioned the Admiral Vladimirsky, this ship. Some of the journalists on your team actually approached it. Why did your team suspect it of being involved in mapping the seafloor?
We had this anonymous former UK Royal Navy expert that tracks the movements of this vessel, specifically this vessel. So he was looking into, like, you know, using intercepts of radio communication. So he helped us get the coordinates for where this vessel could be. So our colleagues from Denmark went to the vicinity of where the ship was, and old school journalism trying to find the ship when it actually was outside of Denmark. And through this tip we got from the UK Royal Navy expert, we managed to find the ship.
Yeah, and what happened when your team approached the boat?
Well, an armed man carrying some kind of Russian rifle exited on deck and just looked very suspiciously at them. He was masked, wearing something that could be a security vest of some kind. And the other men on deck were also masked, but he was the one with a rifle in his hands, just marking his presence and showing them that this is my ship, or I'm guarding this ship and you should not be here. And this was on Danish waters.
Were you able to ask the Kremlin if they know what's going on?
Actually, we have tried to contact the Russian embassies in all of our countries without any response for like several, I would say, weeks now. But today, the Kremlin spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, himself said that the media outlets in Norway, Denmark, Sweden, and Finland are wrong in their conclusions. And once again, they prefer to blame everything on Russia without a reason, Kremlin spokesman Peskov said today to reporters. And he also said that we should focus on investigating the Nord Stream attacks instead of coming with this investigation.
So, Maria, how many Russian vessels in total did your team identify as part of this effort? And what exactly were they looking for on the seafloor?
Our team has found 50 ships in this mapping that we have done that we're able to identify. We cannot state that all of them are somehow engaged in espionage, but we can say that we've documented suspicious behavior from these ships. And what we have is that we've seen them around from Norwegian sites, going through the North Sea, and then we've also seen them coming into Swedish waters. Like 27 of these ships that were in Norway have been in Sweden, for example, like going through harbors and passing through special training areas. We have outside of Gotland, for example, the Swedish island that is interesting for Russia, for example, because it's in the middle of the Baltic Sea, for example. We've seen that this Vladimirsky vessel has been around training areas that are interesting for Russia, and that has caught our attention. And some of these ships have had their transmitting systems completely turned off when they've been in our waters.
So beyond identifying suspicious behavior, were you able to learn anything about an actual plan by Russia sabotaging Europe's energy and communications infrastructure? I mean, is there a plan, or do you suspect they're just gathering intelligence in case?
Well, our colleagues in Denmark have interviewed sources who say that there are plans that are long-term when it comes to creating some kind of, you know, intel to be prepared for some kind of full-scale conflict with the West from the Russian side. While our Norwegian colleagues have been able to find intelligence that say that Moscow is controlling this planned act, but that is highly important for Russia. If this is correct, of course, Peskov is denying this, but for us, it means a lot that these intelligence sources have been able to share this information with us.
Maria Georgieva worked with the Swedish public broadcaster SVT in a joint investigation of Russian spy vessels mapping the floor of the North Sea. Maria, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Turning a bit to the southeast of the North Sea, to Berlin, where Eastern European stand-up comedy is having a moment. In uncertain times, a regular dose of laughter goes a long way. Reporter Alexa Dvorzin in the German capital went to see for herself.
We got everybody here from everywhere. We're going to have a fun evening tonight. It makes it nice if you've been to a comedy show before.
That's Dragos from Romania.
Wonderful. Don't take photos. Don't take videos. Just listen. You know, practice active listening. You know that thing your parents never did with you? You do it here tonight, okay? Break the cycle.
A regular host of stand-up comedy shows like this one, he gets plenty of practice multitasking, East European style.
I was checking in at the door. I'm doing the show. While I'm doing the show, I'm finding seats for people. And at the end, I'm cleaning the toilets, okay? So this is super authentic tonight, okay?
It's a wet, windy Saturday night, but that hasn't deterred a crowd from packing this converted cruise boat anchored in the River Spree, which once formed part of the Cold War border between communist East Germany and West Berlin. Since the legacy of the former Soviet occupation is the source of so many jokes, this is a fitting location.
Make some noise if you're Eastern European in therapy. Look at that. Making therapists a lot of money now. Yeah, that's very good. Young lady, where are you from?
Russia.
Russia, that's a lot of money for therapy. Yes. Every day another reason to go to therapy. Yes. How long have you been doing therapy for?
5 years.
5 years, oi! It's a full-time job, okay. Where is your therapist from?
My current therapist also is from Russia.
From Russia?
Yeah.
That's a wise thing to do. You have to get a therapist from your own region of the world, okay? A therapist that understands your circumstances. My therapist is from Poland, and whenever I tell her stories about my childhood, she has flashbacks.
All the comedians go by first names only. One of them, Dio, is a multilingual black Bulgarian.
Nice to see you guys. Good to see so many different shades of white.
Wow. Literally feels like home. Cannot lie. White people, you gotta love them, man. You just have to. You you got no choice. You know?
Dio jokes that he got out of his country so fast his Bulgarian accent couldn't keep up with him.
I am African and Bulgarian, but I fully identify African-American. Life is easier this way. I tried to say to this one girl from Chicago that I'm African-Bulgarian. She just looked back at me and was like, they make those?
His childhood was terrible, Dio says. But like so many comedians, he's turned it into material.
People just randomly come up to me and be like, yo, you're a rapper, right? You can rap? Come on, bro. I know you have it in you, bro. I'm gonna beatbox. I am five. It doesn't happen this early, you know what I mean? Like, give me a second. Let me learn my stereotypes first.
You know what they say is tragedy plus time equals comedy, right? And I think Eastern Europe has its fair share of tragedy, and now that's been enough time for it to convert into comedy, right?
Dragos was born in November 1989, just before the fall of the Berlin Wall. He grew up during Romania's chaotic transition from communism to democracy.
So I think, you know, we're just using a lot of that experience and knowledge and getting some value out of it, yes, in the form of laughter.
Dragos divides his time between London and Berlin. He's performed in over 100 cities across the continent and beyond.
I think he has a very good understanding of social, historical, political context, which makes it very funny.
It's just, you know, sad people feeling sad, and then that's the funny part.
I'm an Israeli living 7 years in Germany, and I'd say the dark humor that I'm used to, I mean, here it's really mild compared to Israel.
The second half gets darker and darker, okay?
He's not kidding. The next performer, a stand-up comic from Moscow, had to flee Russia when he started getting death threats for his outspoken opposition to the war in Ukraine. After months in Turkey, Dan moved to Berlin with his wife last October. So far, so good. Although his barber told him it takes 3 years to adjust to life in Germany.
3 years is like 10% of my life. I can't afford that. I'm a Russian man, and Russian men don't live long. Our life expectancy is about 2 presidents.
And a short lifespan compounded by low self-esteem, because no one in Russia is raised with unconditional love, Dan jokes. It has to be earned.
You have to, like, ruin your life, then you have to recover, and then you get love. Like my cousin, when he was younger, he was sentenced to 2 years in prison for stealing something. But he behaved well, so they released him for parole a year earlier. And then he became a hero in our family. At every family gathering, they would say, Alex behaved well in prison. So they let him go. And I'm sitting next to my cousin, and nobody praises me for never going to prison.
That packs a punch in light of the scores of Russians who are in prison for condemning the war. Dan relishes the relative calm of life in Berlin.
I like when the days are similar to each other. I enjoy it so much. I've been dreaming about a week when nothing happens.
Do you miss Russia?
Sure. I miss my audience. And I'm sorry that I can't support them, because for them it was like jokes and therapy. Now I just show them a video of me performing somewhere else, and that's sad.
However long it takes, Dan will have plenty of new material when they meet again. For now, he's following a centuries-old tradition of Russians reinventing their lives in a new country. For The World, this is Alexa Dvorsin in Berlin.
Coming up, a restaurant in Boston shakes up its hours and offerings during the Muslim Holy Month.
For Ramadan, we decided to do a buffet.
To serve the nighttime customers who are fasting during the day. That story's just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. The holy month of Ramadan ends this week. It's a time when Muslims abstain from food and drink, among other things, starting from before sunrise to sunset. Some restaurants adjust their operations around those who observe the fast, like the first Yemeni restaurant in Boston, which opened a year ago. Bab al-Yemen means the gate of Yemen, and The World's Sara Hassan paid them a visit to find out what they've been doing this Ramadan.
When you first walk into the Bab al-Yemen restaurant in the heart of Boston, you're immediately transported to another place. There's a carpeted seating area on the floor with cushions and floor tables with fancy designs, and even clay pottery and stained glass windows. From the kitchen, you can hear the bustle of dishes being prepared and a comforting aroma in the air. Ahmed Mahmoud has been living in Boston for 9 years. He was born in New Mexico, moved back to Yemen with his family, and returned to the U.S. for college. He eventually worked for the New York City Department of Education, and then in project management in Washington, D.C. When he first arrived in Boston, he noticed there weren't any Yemeni restaurants.
When I actually wanted to eat Yemeni food, I would go to New York City.
Inspired by his brother's successful restaurant in Malaysia, Mahmoud opened a quick-serve falafel and shawarma restaurant of his own. But when the pandemic struck, he had to close it down. That actually opened the door for a new and unique experience.
Food is the one language that everybody understands. I wanted to do the food as well as the culture with it.
It's the atmosphere of Bab al-Yemen that adds to the experience. Photos on the walls show vibrant cities across Yemen, a country often associated with conflict. There's an image, too, of Mahmoud's hometown of Taiz in southern Yemen. There's even a replica of what a typical Yemeni town would look like. These days, there are special decorations on the walls for Ramadan. Pennant flags with Middle Eastern designs hang from the ceilings, and bright cloths with crescent moons are draped between the restaurant tables.
We've done a lot of dishes that we don't always have. We've added a lot of items, an extensive menu, actually, for Ramadan. The lamb hanid is the best-selling item for us here, so that's something we use a lot for the buffet.
That's slow-roasted lamb mixed with special spices and served over rice.
Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar.
The evening call to prayer marks the moment of breaking the fast. Mahmoud takes a moment to pray in a small room. It's available for customers and staff to use too. The restaurant also opens later in the day throughout the holy month. And even though it opens about an hour before sunset for regular customers, Mahmoud says that some diners who are not Muslim like to join in on the experience and wait to eat with the others. Fasting is only one aspect of the spirit of Ramadan. Bilal Dakka is Palestinian. He came to the restaurant with his friends for iftar.
Well, growing up, Ramadan was basically a lot of family gatherings. And it's also about providing good value to the community as well. Doing good service, donating a lot of food, donating a lot of money.
Another diner, Rami Biktash, grew up in North Carolina. His parents are from Morocco and Lebanon.
For me, it means community. It means patience and gratitude and recognition that for other people, this is a norm.
Biktash is referring to the idea that fasting is meant to create empathy for those who can't afford food. Yemen is one country where millions of people are food insecure, a result of years of civil war and conflict. Mahmoud says everyone in the country has been affected in some way.
I've seen that the middle class has been wiped, people in dire need. I've known a lot of people that were doing okay or doing so well that are not doing as well anymore. A lot of people have lost their jobs. The Yemeni passport won't even take you anywhere. No one will even accept you. So they can't leave. They can't stay and live in dignity.
Recent talks between Saudi Arabia and Yemen's Houthi fighters have seen a breakthrough. Last Friday, the two sides began a prisoner swap, exchanging hundreds of detainees. Peace efforts have failed in the past, but Mahmoud is cautiously optimistic.
Well, I'm full of hope. I hope that something will change for people. We've seen a lot of glimpses of hope, but didn't end up to materialize anywhere. Usually, Yemenis are the ones who are suffering. I hope and pray that this is going to help Yemenis.
In the meantime, Mahmoud hopes that through his restaurant, he can share his culture and cuisine with others around the world to help them see a different and more beautiful side of Yemen. For The World, I'm Sarah Hassan.
Videos and photos of Bab al-Yemen's iftar dinners are on our website, theworld.org. Take a look, and while you're there, explore other stories from our reporters around the globe that you might have missed. If it's not food, there's always music to bring people together, like the band from Ghana, Fra. Fra means mix in the Ghanaian Akan language. It's precisely what the band is all about, a combination of musical styles and influences ranging from old-school Ghanaian pop to disco. Here's one of the band members from Fra to explain.
My name is Emmanuel Salom Donyo. I'm the guitar player. We are from the band Fra, from Accra, Ghana.
primarily our music is about having fun. We are actually hoping that when people listen to our music, we are spreading messages of love, of unity, and our fervent hope is that people will listen to these songs and it will touch their hearts some way, somehow, and they'll forget about all these differences they have and come together as one and just enjoy music, enjoy good music. We have a couple of singles of the album, 30 Billion, which is like a disco funk song, very groovy and very danceable, of our upcoming project, which is called Chalawate. Chalawate is a catchphrase which you find in Ghana. It basically means friend, let's go, or all in all, let's go. So we are on a journey and we started out and we are accelerating towards a particular goal. And when you look at the songs on the album, we chronicle a lot of everyday issues which most of us have experienced, from heartbreak to friendship to love, all in all, toying with human emotions. And so we are taking the listeners on a ride, a roller coaster ride, so to speak. And we are asking them to come along with us on this journey and stay gripped to us. So that's why the album is called Chale Wote. So friend, come and let's go.
Keep the style, don't change the vibe. Life goes around just like a merry-go-round. Never stress.
That was Emmanuel Salom Donor of the band Fra from Accra, Ghana. Their latest single, Smile, takes us to the break. And you are listening to The World. Eighty years ago today, the start of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. Today, that civilian resistance symbolizes a red line.
The notion that there is a time when you just do have to fight. You can't negotiate anymore.
Also, Apple opens its first stores in India, and it's about way more than selling phones and tablets. Still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. This week, 3 years ago, a gunman in Nova Scotia killed 22 people in a mass shooting. It was Canada's deadliest massacre in modern times and led to sweeping new restrictions on some kinds of firearms. That move is still having repercussions throughout Canada, where more and more guns are becoming central to politics. Jimmy Thompson reports from British Columbia.
Jonas Carr owns a gun shop in Chilliwack, about an hour inland from Vancouver.
It's some scary stuff going on. They're trying to turn it into a police state, some communism stuff going on here. I'm not a fan. Not a fan.
The shop is decorated with classic gun store stuff, like a sign saying 0% liberal and an Uncle Sam-like rendering of Prime Minister Justin Trudeau saying, I want your guns. But the thing is, the sign isn't wrong, exactly. The Prime Minister really does want their guns. Since the Nova Scotia massacre, the Liberal government has made major moves to curb the availability of guns in Canada, including a full ban on the sale, transportation, use, or possession of handguns. It's not yet clear how the government plans to collect those guns, but either way, it wasn't popular with Carr or his customers.
That was about 30% of our business.
Soon after came Bill C-21, still in Parliament, which carries a whole suite of new restrictions. There's a red flag law that would prevent some people who may present a danger to themselves or others from having guns, more power to suspend or revoke firearms licenses, and harsher penalties for smuggling or altering firearms. Groups like Doctors for Protection from Guns have been calling for steps such as these. The group was established following a different shooting in downtown Toronto in 2018. Trauma surgeon Najma Ahmed is its founder.
This sort of galvanized and awakened many people in the country to the idea that we are not immune from mass shootings, that this is not a U.S.-only phenomenon.
Dr. Achmed is touching on the elephant in the room in Canadian gun discourse, our southern neighbor.
We share a very long unguarded border with the United States, which is an opportunity for illegal smuggling for sure. And to an extent, I believe that we are much more influenced by U.S. politics and culture than potentially other parts of the world.
One place where that American influence has shown up, she believes, is the Canadian Coalition for Firearms Rights, a pro-gun lobbying group. The CCFR denies any connection to the U.S. or the NRA. It calls itself the Reasonable Gun Lobby and advocates for what it calls fair treatment of gun owners. It is currently mounting a court challenge to the government's order that banned handguns.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 140 of the CCFR Radio podcast. I'm your host, Rod Giltaka. Thanks for joining me again today on the show.
Rod Giltaka is CCFR's CEO.
Hello.
Hey, Jimmy.
Rod.
How are you?
I went to see Giltaka in his podcast studio a few minutes' drive from the gun store in Chilliwack. A fluorescent sign bears CCFR's logo, a distinctive rifle, bisecting a maple leaf.
What's the firearm in the middle of it?
It's an AR-15.
A controversial choice. Why did you go with that?
Well, because the AR-15 is probably the most common semi-automatic rifle in North America. I love AR-15s. I have six of them.
They're also the weapon of choice for mass shooters in the U.S. in particular. Does that sort of taint it in your mind?
Well, no, because I think that's incorrect. It's not the weapon of choice. It's a common rifle.
That rifle is currently banned in Canada, though owners like Giltaka are allowed to possess them for now. Giltaka says he got involved in firearms rights because a different gun he owned was suddenly reclassified as prohibited. That could have landed him in prison, he says.
I had stayed away from politics previous to that, and I realized at that point that someone has to look for some basic fairness in the firearm regulatory system in Canada.
Gun laws hit different in Canada than the U.S. There is nothing like the Second Amendment here that provides a right to own guns. There are also far fewer gun deaths in Canada than the U.S., about a fifth as many per capita. The Nova Scotia mass shooting was a horrific exception, and one that Giltaka is quick to point out was perpetrated with guns smuggled in from the States.
This person was left free to illegally smuggle firearms into Canada and go on the largest spree shooting in Canadian history with them. The government turned around and used that to ban guns from licensed gun owners in Canada.
But gun crimes are on the rise, too. Carr, the gun shop owner, points to cities like nearby Vancouver and their gang-related shootings.
Sure, they got some crime and issues and stuff in the urban areas, but those are different issues that need to be dealt with in those areas, right? And a lot of those guns are not being sold in my store. Like, gangsters don't come to my store to buy guns to do shootings. Like, that doesn't happen, man.
According to government statistics, the gun crime rate is actually similar or higher in rural areas. The urban-rural divide also shows up in voting patterns in Canada along the same lines as in the U.S. The CCFR's views are well aligned with those of Conservative Party leader Pierre Poilievre, who is positioned to take on Justin Trudeau in the next election. Some provinces are moving in the opposite direction of the federal government with new laws that prevent gun buybacks or seizures. Another sign, the gun debate is seeping into politics at every level more than any time in recent memory. For The World, I'm Jimmy Thompson in Chilliwack, British Columbia.
Apple's CEO Tim Cook is in India today to open the country's first ever Apple stores, one in Mumbai today and a second in Delhi tomorrow. It's been possible to buy Apple products online in India for years, but these are the company's first retail locations in the country. Anusha Chari joins me to talk about how big of a deal this is. She's a professor of economics and finance with a focus on India at the University of North Carolina. Anusha, if Indians have been able to buy Apple products in India for a while, how significant are these two brick-and-mortar stores?
So I think there is a sort of a general sense of excitement about, you know, American and European and foreign firms setting up retail locations in India. And I think this is indicative of how large the market is. But I'd like to sort of point out that this is tapping into a sort of a luxury segment of the market. And given that India has 1 billion plus people, even a small fraction of that translates into very large revenues for companies like Apple.
Do we know if Apple's just interested in sales, or are these brick-and-mortar stores kind of part of a larger strategy or investment pattern in India?
The key question is, from India's point of view, is as global value chains reconfigure, whether Apple is going to be manufacturing in India. And that's going to be a key question for a number of firms like Apple. And I believe that Apple is trying to set up a big manufacturing hub in India. And if that becomes a base from which they export, that is going to be very significant.
Yeah, so just generally, how much of Apple's investment in India is a strategy to basically curb its reliance on China?
I think it's a very significant part of the strategy. It's still a majority of the manufacturing is still happening in China, but I think that they are slowly trying to reconfigure to reduce over-reliance on China.
Yeah, what do these companies like Apple, what do they see as advantages in India?
These are sort of high-value manufacturers, right? So it's not like it's going to use a lot of local labor. But I think it's primarily a market that is seen as having compatible values in terms of democracy, being English-speaking, having an English-speaking workforce, et cetera. And so that sort of creates a competing market, you know, what people are calling friendshoring. It could be a part of that. And creating manufacturing hubs with countries that are perceived as allies.
So the UN announced this week that India's population will outgrow China's by the middle of this year based off its estimates. I'm curious if you think that's going to impact how businesses and investors see India.
Absolutely. They absolutely see India as a very large market, domestic market that they want to tap into. But as I mentioned before, purchasing power is going to be an issue. And that's why we see the mid-range market is actually very deep. And companies like Samsung and Nokia and Google, et cetera, are trying to tap into that market rather than the luxury end of things. And just to give you an example, like an Indian-made cell phone, it can be bought for $20, right? And so a lot of people have these Indian-made cell phones, and so $800 minimum for an Apple iPhone is a far, it's just way out of reach for many people.
Anusha Chari is a professor of economics and finance at the University of North Carolina. Really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thanks, Marco.
Every year, tens of thousands of people travel through Central America and Mexico trying to reach the U.S. It is a brutal journey. Many die along the way, hunger or thirst, sometimes murder. When there is a death, identification of the body is often difficult. A forensics program established in South America is helping families of migrants find closure. From Buenos Aires, Argentina, Natalia Cosoy has that story.
Bertila Parada de Osorio lives in Sonsonate, El Salvador. Her 27-year-old son left their home on March 17, 2011, hoping to reach the United States. My son's name was Carlos Alberto Osorio Parada, she tells me.
Bueno, él emprendió el viaje porque, pues, en nuestro país hay muchas faltas de oportunidades.
He decided to leave because there's a lack of financial opportunities in our country, but he never made it to the U.S. Parada had to wait for a year and 9 months to learn that he had been buried with dozens of other victims in clandestine graves in northeast Mexico. They had been murdered by the Zetas criminal gang.
Yo había recibido mucho terapias psicológicas y la psicóloga siempre quería hacer un cierre, aun cuando Carlos todavía no había venido.
I had received a lot of psychotherapy, she says, and the therapist wanted to bring everything to a close, even though Carlos had not yet returned. And the therapist told me, we will bury Carlos, you will say goodbye to him, you will take him flowers.
Yo me le levanté y le dije, pues yo no lo puedo enterrar porque no lo he enterrado. Yo no me puedo despedir porque no lo he visto.
Parada recalls that she stood up and told the therapist, I cannot bury him because I haven't buried him. I cannot say goodbye to him because I have not seen him. Parada ended up getting help from an organization 4,000 miles away in Argentina. The Argentinian Forensic Anthropology Team, or the IAF, has been dealing for decades with relatives of the disappeared. And they know all about this particular trauma. The team honed their expertise looking for the bodies of people that had been kidnapped and disappeared by the dictatorship that ruled Argentina between 1976 and 1983. That search is still ongoing, like at this dig in the outskirts of Buenos Aires. I'm standing in the middle of this dirt yard, which is about the size of two basketball courts. It's full of garbage, leaves, pieces of paper, old car plates, and this used to be the back of a clandestine detention center that worked here.
So we start very slowly from surface, just maybe we open like 20 centimeters, 30 centimeters.
This is anthropologist Mariela Fumagalli, who is leading the search. She has reasons to believe that bodies were buried here more than 40 years ago. And what happens if you find something that you can consider potentially forensic evidence?
Well, at that point, we stop the operation and we start to work with manual shovels, just trying to understand the dimensions of the finding.
When a body is found and identified, it has a profound impact on the relatives of those who had been missing for so long. Hola.
¿Cómo va?
Bien, vos?
¿Qué tal?
I visit Fernando Araldi in his flat in Buenos Aires. His father, his mother, his grandfather and aunts were killed or disappeared by the dictatorship. In 2010, the IAF asked him to go to their office without telling him exactly why.
Cuando fue la noticia, obviamente tardé un tiempo en procesarlo.
When I got the news, I took a while to process it all, Araldi says. The team had identified the remains of his father, who had been buried in an unmarked grave in the province of Tucumán in northern Argentina. Araldi didn't delay going to see him.
Y me encontré con mi padre, digamos, en forma de esqueleto, ¿no? Es como esqueleto armado sobre una mesa.
And I met my father in skeletal form, a skeleton assembled on a table, he says. And he becomes flesh and bone, almost literally, even if the flesh is missing. So something changed for me. I started the process of recognizing my father as a human, you know? The victims and the relatives like Araldi are at the heart of what the IAF does. In 2010, they used their expertise to launch the Border Project. The aim was to help identify the remains of migrants who died in their journey towards the United States.
The families were very, very upset that they will receive a sealed coffin. They will be told not to open it.
Mercedes Doretti is co-founder of the Argentine Forensic Anthropology Team and coordinator of the Border Project.
They will just tell them, these are the remains of your loved one. And they were always having these major doubts about, do I have the right body? Is this are these really the remains of my loved one?
To answer those questions, the IAF built a network of partners in Central America, Mexico and the US that allowed, from 2010 up until the end of March 2023, to identify the remains of 292 migrants. Like Carlos Alberto, Bertila Parada's son. When the IAF first phoned her, she had been receiving threats and was scared.
Y le digo que es de las cosas más suaves, palabras más adecuadas que yo he podido escuchar.
And let me tell you, she says, they said some of the nicest, most adequate words I've heard in this process since my son disappeared and was killed. The IAF helped Parada stop the Mexican authorities from cremating Carlos's body. They wanted to make sure that his remains were properly identified and sent back to their hometown. And they did. They arrived in February 2015.
Y así fue como pude yo hacer la despedida de Carlos en medio de muchísima gente que vino, una presencia de unos 800 personas.
That's how I managed to have my farewell for Carlos, she says. With lots of people, some 800. I bought flowers, people gave me money, I could have flower arrangements. It was like a garden. And after almost 4 years, I could bury Carlos.
Ahora está en mi pueblo y tengo yo la No tengo duda, una siquiera.
He's now in my town, and I know, without a doubt, who I take flowers to, Parada says. I know for 100% that the Argentinian team delivered Carlos to me. For the world, I'm Natalio Cosoy in Buenos Aires.
On this day in 1943, Nazi soldiers entered the Jewish ghetto in Warsaw, Poland. Instead of marching the residents out of their homes and detaining them, the Nazis were met with armed resistance. It was the beginning of what came to be known as the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. It's being remembered today by Jews around the world. To mark the uprising's 80th anniversary, we're joined by Peter Black. He's a former senior historian for the Center for Advanced Holocaust Studies at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. Peter, set the scene for us. It's 1943. World War II is well underway. What was life like in the Warsaw Ghetto and the days leading up to April 19th, 1943?
The situation, the Warsaw Ghetto had been minimalized, as the Germans put it, in that the vast majority of the population that was still surviving into 1942 had already been either killed or deported to the killing center at Treblinka. Some 70,000 people were left living in the ghetto, along with probably another several thousand who were not known to the Jewish council. And they were getting along as long as they could continue working because they got enough rations to survive since the Germans needed their work.
So what did people in the ghetto know about Nazi plans for them?
By the days leading up to 1943, they knew quite a bit. And in fact, there had been some resistance in an earlier deportation effort in January of 1943, in which the SS had hoped to get 10,000 Jews out of the ghetto, but were only able to get about 5,000.
So as far as the Jewish resistance, how was that organized?
The Jewish resistance was organized in small units. The number of actual fighters was just a small minority of the general population. Most of the Jews were instructed to hide as best they could in bunkers, of which many were built in the winter months of 1943. And the communications were passed by courier, and there were several so-called safe areas, which weren't very safe, along with the headquarters at Myla Street 18.
The headquarters for the resistance.
For the resistance, correct.
So talk about the battle. How were the residents of the Warsaw Ghetto able to hold out for so long against a much more powerful force?
Well, actually, the major part of the resistance was broken within a couple of days, as you would expect if you're talking about a couple of hundred active fighters going against tanks and 3,000 or 4,000 soldiers coming in. That being said, the Germans had to work and also continue to take casualties as they had to go from building to building to sort of uncover all of these bunkers in which some of the Jews were armed with firearms or with Molotov cocktails and proved not to be afraid to use them in futile but still effective attempts to resist the Germans to the last man. And it took the Germans about a month until they could declare that the Warsaw Ghetto was destroyed.
What happened to the residents of the Warsaw Ghetto once that operation was ended?
Of the 70,000 that were left, approximately 42,000 were deported to various forced labor camps. Some 7,000 were deported to the Treblinka Killing Center and killed there, presumably upon arrival. At least 7,000 were killed during the actual uprising in the fighting or as a consequence of the fighting. And I suspect several thousand more were killed during the systematic destruction of the ghetto, building by building, either by fire or by explosion.
Peter, what did this event, the uprising in the Warsaw Ghetto, actually mean? I mean, like many historical events, it's got echoes and lessons that live on. How does its memory resonate today?
I should note that its immediate effect was to frighten the Germans to death. And they were quite afraid of future uprisings. And of course, the Warsaw Ghetto uprising was known to other Jewish communities that were still surviving. For us today, it has significance in the notion that there is a time when you just do have to fight. You can't negotiate anymore, and that it was important for the remaining survivors of the Warsaw Ghetto to mount a hopeless defense in the hopes, as they stated openly before they died, that this would be remembered, that the Jews did not go peacefully to the slaughter. And we must also remember this event in the effort to preserve democratic institutions around the world and here in the United States, to make sure that attacks on groups of people by state-sponsored agencies never happen again. And we have a lot of work to do, as the history of the world since 1945 has shown.
Peter Black is a former senior historian for the Center for Advanced Holocaust Studies in the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. We've been discussing the history of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising that began 80 years ago today. Peter, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me, Marco.
Leave you today with a traditional Yiddish song often played at the end of a wedding party. Musicians would strike up Der Gassen Nin as a tired guest started for home. The title roughly translates to street song. And we play it today in homage of the historic moment when people took to the streets during the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. This version of the song is performed by New York-based Israeli virtuoso clarinetist Aaron Etkin in a 2014 recording. That is The World on this Wednesday. We come to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for being with us today. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.